crackers to the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll school you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me do my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. To CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ, leave you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. This is dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial codes, source codes, ISOs, RANs, zip sits. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers.
Welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode 28. Coming to you January 13th, 2004. I am Stank Dog, and I am joined again this week by the one and only Voodoo Hal in the house.
Hello again, everybody.
And once again, we have another action-packed episode of Binary Revolution Radio. We have a lot of stuff to talk about today. We're going to continue the list of 101 ways to save the Internet. And we have a lot of feedback on the show this week, so I think probably we should jump into that, stay with our normal format. And our first email comes from, and forgive me if I mispronounce this, I say that's like every time I get an email, I always have to preface with that because some of these names, man, how come we can never get like Bubba or Frank or Jethro or something like that? No, I had a really, really good email, and I apologize, but I'm hoping this is pronounced Axia, A-Q-X-E-A, Axia. He says, quote, I just visited your website for the first time, and I love your radio show. Thank you very much. I'm listening to the Telephonic Craptacular right now, and it's a riot. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. Thank you for listening to the show. That was totally an experimental thing, and I'm surprised at the feedback I've gotten from it. So, yeah, I guess I'm remotivated to maybe do that again for episode 50 if we make it that far, or maybe just a surprise episode whenever I get enough material. I really didn't know how that was going to go over at all. I thought that was just going to make... It made me laugh, but I laugh at a lot of weird stuff sometimes. And, you know, by all means, pass information about the show along to anyone you think might find it interesting. Email it to people, put it on your blogs, put it on your website. Get more people coming to listen. We have new listeners every week, growing slowly. Word of mouth gets out there. By all means, spread the word out there and tell people that we exist and tell people that we have a good time and we hopefully provide some interesting material and content and teach some things on the show. I am still getting feedback to this day about the Craptacular, and I saw at least one website, and someone said that they had forwarded an email parts of the Craptacular. Particularly, I guess people liked the call to the RAAA and all my attempts at voice and celebrity impersonations, such as they are. And it's been circulating, I guess, a little bit, so hopefully that'll draw in some people just for the comedy, just for the humor aspect of it, and hopefully when they get here and they find out that we are a hacking show and that we are technology-based, then maybe they'll stick around and listen. We have some humor in there as well, but by all means, spread it out there and get people interested however you feel the need. Just please, if you can, leave the MP3 tag intact or give people a URL, let them know that we exist and where we're at, and hopefully we'll continue to get new listeners and we can continue to put out good shows. Hopefully. And I got another one this week from, well, a person who mentioned their real name, and we're not going to mention that on the air because I never know how people feel about that. But I'll just say it's good to hear from a fellow academician, so they know who they are. And they say, they're referring, well, let me read it first. It says, as per the article below, I suggest a new definition for the word hacker as follows. Any individual who uses a tool of any kind in an attempt to perform any act that, by its nature, range from mildly irritating to outright malicious. How much wider can a definition get? Now, and then he provides a link, and the link is something some of the listeners may have heard of. Voodoo Hal, I think we were talking about this earlier, about the Burger King drive-through, about somebody, it's not all that difficult, you find the frequency and broadcast through that frequency, people in the drive-through, and kind of mess with them, tell them that you're out of food or you don't do this, and basically interfere with the drive-through functions.
Yeah.
It's a prank. You know, I think it's kind of funny. It's not all that, you know, I guess it's harmless. It could be annoying, very annoying, but you drive up to the window, you give them your order after all, and, you know, life goes on. It's not that big of a deal. But I guess the article threw the word hacker around. So, of course, that doesn't necessarily, they don't necessarily go hand in hand. As far as their definition, let me read their definition they gave again. It says, any individual who uses a tool of any kind in an attempt to perform any act that by its nature range from mildly irritating to outright malicious. Now, I don't think that defines 99% of hacking, but that's just me. I don't think, I guess it's application of hacking that could contain that. But hacking itself is, and we've said this so many times, that it's about learning and it's about figuring out the levels and the limits of things and going outside of the boundaries and figuring out what technology can and can't do and how to make it things do things that we didn't think possible and push it beyond the known boundaries and push the boundaries further. The application of these hacking techniques could turn into pranks. They could turn into these annoying things. They could turn into downright crimes. And that's why we get on the soapbox every once in a while about throwing the word hacker out there, because somebody breaks into a bank or somebody does some kind of fraud online. That's not what hacking is about. That is somebody applying hacking principle to a criminal activity. That doesn't mean that that's what hacking is about. Those are independent actions that are completely separate and independent from what hacking is. Do you agree? Am I?
I think you're being a little nice, and for what? I'm gonna get up on the soapbox for a moment.
Well, wait, before you, I'm pretty sure they meant this sarcastically.
Okay, that's better then, because I mean that's got to be the worst definition I've ever seen of hacker. I mean, if you think about a simple example of Bubba down the road. Everybody knows a Bubba or some form of Bubba and the essence of Bubba. We won't go there. Anyway, so let's say Bubba decides to do a mailbox bashing with a baseball bat. A baseball bat would be his tool. His pickup truck would be his tool. That would be mildly irritating or outright malicious, but I would never call Bubba a hacker.
Well, the snow cone story comes to mind.
Well, you know I live in the South. I'm always coming up with the hillbilly joke.
The hillbilly hackers. Now, yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure they meant this sarcastically. I'm almost positive of it. They were basically saying, you know, the newspapers are probably going to, you know, this is what the newspapers think. They were saying this is what people think the definition of a hacker is, when it's really not. And I don't think they meant it that way. I'm pretty sure they were pointing out the idiocy of the article and how they're portraying hackers. So, yeah, that's absolutely right. It's you know, you apply something that someone else has learned or someone else has figured out. Someone else, being the hacker, you know, figures out how to how to create a denial of service attack, and then some script kiddie goes out and downloads some DOS tool and attacks a site. That does not make a hacker, you know. He's using something that someone else made. So, same thing with this. However, I'm still going to go back and say, I think it's kind of funny. You know, it's a prank. And, I mean, gosh, if you can't laugh and have fun in the world anymore, I think that's really harmless. As long as they're not doing it every day, disrupting the flow of business for hours upon hours. You know, it's a prank. It's hacking. I guess I would say it's application of some hacking ideas and techniques, radio and frequencies and you know, stuff like that. Technically, it's illegal. You know, the FCC probably has something to say about that, but, you know, I don't know, it's not a crime. So I don't want to do the same thing the media does. Just because they did a prank or a joke, it's still not a crime. It's not hacking either, but let's put it in perspective. You know, they played a joke. Get over it. Anyway, you know, and I had a line here, and I don't know if I want to bother reading this because it sounds kind of corny now that I read it, but. Well, okay, I'll read it. I don't know if how this sounds kind of silly now that I'm looking at my writing, but I wrote a note to myself that says, trying to define hacking is like trying to grab a handful of water. You know what it is, you know what it looks like, you know what it feels like, but when you grab it, you have it for a second, suddenly it's gone. See, the definition of a hacker and what a hacker is polymorphic in and of itself. It changes. It's always about thinking and progressing, and what a hacker was yesterday is completely different from what a hacker is today and from what a hacker is tomorrow. So on top of the fact that nobody seems to ever get it and understand it, they also can't wrap their mind around the fact that it changes, you know?
Isn't that the argument of awareness, actually?
What's that?
Isn't the metaphor, I guess, you just gave used to define awareness as well?
Yeah, I guess it could be.
It's the argument of being aware of awareness. Anyway.
Boy, you're getting real deep now, aren't you? This is a hacking show, man. What are we? We can't talk that deep. Let's lighten it back up. Actually, and this is one of the best emails I've gotten in a while, and this is from a longtime friend of the show, Archangel. And he sent me a news story, a Yahoo News story. Or so I thought, anyway. I got an email that looked like one of those, you go to a site and it says, click here to send this story to a friend, and it'll mail the URL to that person or mail the article or whatever it was. So I got an email that was from Yahoo, and forwarded story or something like that, that you'll find this interesting. So I assumed it was some kind of article on hacking or technology or digital rights or something that he was forwarding me and wanted me to read. So I got the email, and I skimmed through it, and I'm looking, and I'm like, okay, well, where's the story? Where's the link? There's nothing there. Except a note from him saying, I thought you might find this interesting. So I'm looking at it, and I'm like, well, maybe something messed up. Maybe there's a mistake, something screwed up. But actually, as I looked again, I noticed that there was a problem. Well, not a problem. There was a bug, I guess you'd say, with the email itself. I noticed that the from address was from, autostories@yahoo.com or something like that, automatic story submission at yahoo.com, something like that. But the reply to address was archangel@binrev.com, which is an address that doesn't actually exist. So I'm looking at that. I'm like, wait a minute. What is he trying to tell me here? And I realized it. So I started playing around with it, went to the site, tried to recreate it the same way, and basically the form that you're presented doesn't verify the submission email address, whether it's valid or not, before sending the email out. And I bet you it's not just on Yahoo. I bet you a lot of other places. So if you think about this, you can see the potential for abuse of something like this. First of all, and Voodoo Hal, I think you probably agree with me on this, they don't care whether the email is valid or identified. They're not going to verify any of that kind of stuff. They want the traffic. You're going to send a story out to someone, to one of your friends' emails or one of your coworkers or something like that. They don't care. As long as it generates traffic and a hit to their site, that's all they want. I mean, am I wrong?
Oh, exactly. It's all about the hits.
Right. And so they're not going to verify it. They couldn't care less. They probably haven't even thought about it. So they let it happen. And what that actually does is, I don't know if there's already a term out there, but I call it subversive spam, because you see this and you send it to your coworkers and generate a hit for them, or you see it and you send it to a mailing list or whatever, and basically you're forwarding out the links to their site for them. So you're doing the work that they don't have to pay a spammer or become a spammer to do. So the potential for abuse there, obviously, is that you can write a script. You can write a script that will go out there and mass mail this to Well, infinite amount of people, as many people as you want. I did play around with it and found a couple other little tricks, though. And I'll post the link up in the show notes. But combine the fact that it doesn't verify, that just is one fun thing to do with it. On top of that, you can do a little URL manipulation, URL abuse, as I've labeled it a long time back. And as it turns out, you can actually create headlines and stories forwards by abusing the URL itself to stuff that doesn't even exist. And I actually have a screenshot, and I'll put it in the gallery by the time the show airs, so you can check out in the gallery in the members or private area or something like that it's called, where we put up our little hacks and screenshots. I'll put it up there, but basically it shows how you can kind of abuse the URL a little bit. And secondly, I didn't push it this far, but I had this idea in mind. Yahoo keeps track of how many times those stories get forwarded around. And pictures on Yahoo. Do you have a Yahoo account?
Yes.
So you know that they also have a feature where they show the most forwarded pictures and most forwarded and hot list of most popular stories and stuff like that. Well, what I'm wondering is, they obviously count them based on how many people forward that email out. Well, if I abuse it and forward my http://stankdog.com address, if I abuse it and put that out and then write a script to it to generate a million hits like that, do you think it's possible? Do you think they're dumb enough to let me backdoor my way into the top of their forwarded, most forwarded sites list or most forwarded news stories list?
I think we should find out.
Well, there's only one way to find out, but yeah, I didn't go there this time. That remains to be seen. I might have to give that a shot just to see if it can be done, but that could be very interesting. That could be very funny to see at the top of Yahoo.com, most forwarded stories, a link to StankDog.com or BenRev.com or whatever. I think that could be, if they haven't thought this through and that allows me to do that, that could be funny. I don't know, maybe I should email them and tell them about that first and see. But anyway, for that cool trick, Archangel, thank you for sending me that email. I saw it, figured it out right away, and went and gave me about half hour to an hour worth of hacking around playing on Yahoo sites. So for that, contact me, and I will set you up an archangel@beanrev.com address. I'll redirect it. All I can do is really set up a redirector and send it to whatever email address you want. But if you want the vanity email address, contact me, and you won't have to spoof it in the future. You can actually have a valid email address. So thank you for that very much. I appreciate it. And that wraps up the mailbag for this week. Now, going into, you know what, I've been running my mouth for a while. Let's do the show and tell here. Let's talk about our personal stuff. And why don't you bring us up to date, if there is anything to bring up to date, on your DVD escapades we talked about last week.
There's not a whole lot. Spent most all of, I guess, Sunday. Yeah, I think that was the day. One day last week, working on it. We didn't talk about this, but it was a pretty big nightmare, actually. If you guys ever had one of those days, it's just nothing seems to be going right. I mean, no matter what you do, starting your car doesn't go right. The simple things in life don't go right, and that was that day.
Yikes.
We just ran into so many, and it wasn't... The whole thing should have been easy, and I mean, it really is. The problems we ran into were things like, we decided to go with Debian for our distribution on the servers themselves, which I would say I'm very familiar with Debian since I run it almost all my machines now.
Sounds like a good choice.
Yeah, if I'm running Linux, it's going to be Debian. Well, I've had this problem happen one other time, and I still don't know what caused it, but I don't know if some of you have used Debian, you know that they have... they have apt, which is an automatic dependency thing. If you want to install something, like one total line, and it'll go out and get all your dependencies and install them for you. Well, it keeps a database or a file of all the dependencies that are installed or all the packages that have been installed. Well, one other time I've had it become corrupt. I mean, the file just disappeared. It was gone. And so anytime you tried to add a new application, it would want to install everything because there were no dependencies installed, including the base Linux system. So it'd want to go out and install it. Yeah. So after 2 or 3 hours of getting the Debian, the first machine up exactly how we wanted it, we realized, oh, okay, we need to install Secure Shell on this thing. And that's when it started. We tried apt-get open Secure Shell, and all of a sudden it started trying to install everything, and we had no way of recovering it. So that was just the one thing that went wrong.
Wow.
And we decided to go with Debian again, and after getting that up and going again, we had that fine. And then I was there and had to do a couple other things, some data recovery on another Linux machine that didn't want to boot for anything. So right now we have one node, or one of the 8 processor machines installed. We should be finishing it in the next 2 weeks or so, hopefully. So not a lot of good news on the front, but oh well.
Well, and you know, the thing is, you know, that's part of hacking a lot of times. You're pushing stuff that's never been done before, or at least never been done before by you, and until you actually get into it, you know, you figure out what's, you know, you come up with obstacles and hurdles, and the thing is, you're able to get through them.
Right.
You know, that's the sign of being a hacker, is when you find that and you hit that challenge, and you work your way through it and figure out how to get through it. Now, you may not get through it as quickly as you'd like, but getting it going. So, hopefully by next time we talk about it, you'll have some better news for us, I hope.
Yeah, well, I can also give you some simple stats on, we got one of the 8 processor nodes up and going, and we ran DNetC, obviously, the pretty great benchmarking tool these days.
Yeah.
And we're pulling about 15 million keys per second on one 8 processor machine, so
Woo-hoo.
Not bad.
Youch! Man, you're going to jump, you're going to leapfrog to the top with that. Leapfrog,
yeah, if we can get all 4 going, plus all those Ripper nodes, we'd be doing pretty good.
Wow, yep, very much. You know, that's what those top teams are doing. They're putting it on this big heavy metal system. So, yeah, that'll help tremendously. Probably next weekend, I guess, this upcoming weekend, I guess you'll have time to work on it some more?
Yeah, we were supposed to do it tonight, actually, or earlier today, but the other person who actually has access to the hardware had to back out.
Right. Well, if you had Secure Shell on there, you could... but anyway. Now, for me, this past week, I don't even know if I should bring this up and jinx myself. Because you and I were talking about this before. Yeah, I guess it won't... Yeah, I don't believe in jinxes. Here we go. I switched from Bell South DSL, because people have heard me rant on how much I hate them. And I do. Really, really, really do. I finally broke down and switched to Comcast. I mean, they doubled it from 1.5 to 3 megabits per second. How can you say no to that? How can you not try that? You know? So I finally pulled the trigger. I shouldn't say finally. Actually, it was not available to me until fairly recently. So when I saw it was available, they jumped into 3, I had to jump on it. So I had them install that a couple days ago. So far, so good. I haven't tried to get it working with my internal network and my wireless access point, stuff like that. But right now, it's hooked up and working directly to my one main PC that we're doing a show on right now, and do the streaming on, and it's fast. It's really, really good. It's very cool. So I'm going to let these run concurrently for a few more days, maybe a week at the most, and as long as everything's stable and as long as I can get my networking equipment to work with this, I think I'm going to cut off the DSL. I'm sure I'm going to cut off the DSL if I can get working. And then the next step beyond that is to cancel the phone service completely. I will have BellSouth out of my life completely, which will be a joyous occasion. We'll have a special celebration episode for that. I haven't decided what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to go cell phone only, just stick with the cell phone from my main phone company, or probably more than likely I'll try out Vonage, Box, or Packet 8 or one of those type things. So I will be doing my research, talking with Decoder and Lucky225, those guys, see what they still recommend, because one week it's one thing, another week it's something else. So let's see what the flavor of the month is, and make a decision myself and try one out so I can get long distance, all you can eat for a reasonable amount, and not have to pay the phone company's outrageous fees. So that was what the majority of my past weekend was getting my computer room all rewired and stuff like that. So I'm going on with that right now. Also, I mentioned a while back on the show geocaching. And I forgot to mention since that time, when we did the Telephonic Craptacular, it was kind of, we took a little bit of break for the holidays, and during that time, I actually went on my first geocache. And I've been meaning to mention that on the air, but I never got around to it. But I found a geocache close to where I work, actually. I went out with my friend Saitu, my friend Womp, both of whom you'll see in Hack TV, some other friends, and went on a little first geocache just for the fun of it. And it was surprisingly fun. Even, you know, for nothing else but for a nice walk outside, get a breath of fresh air, see the scenery and stuff like that. It was really fun, and I do think I might do some more. I find some more locally, or maybe even if I go on a trip out of town, I might find one while I'm out of town. That adds to the challenge of it, not knowing the area. So, I had a lot of fun. Have you ever been on a geocache before?
Never.
Never? Ever had the desire?
Every once in a while.
Not really. Yeah, that. Let me translate that. No. it's kind of fun. It's
I haven't seen the sun in years. Okay.
Yeah. Right. That's what I'm saying is I kind of spend so much time in front of the computer between work and the show and side work and playing at home, et cetera, et cetera. A reason to go outside and to do something like that. I try to get outside as much as I can, but every new reason helps. So I thought it was pretty fun, and I liked it. And like I said, nothing more than getting out for a breath of fresh air, you know, as fresh as our air is these days, which is a whole nother rant we won't even talk about. And so a little ammo box that was out there, and I didn't take anything out, but I slipped in a copy of Binary Revolution magazine. Maybe somebody will find it and like it. Who knows? So, yeah, I mentioned, I meant to mention that on an earlier show and forgot all about it. So, thanks to Droops, actually, for getting me kind of inspired and letting me learn about what it was. So, shouts to him for getting me interested. Now, our main topic coming up in the show, and we're a good ways into the show, but our main topic coming up is going to be on the GPL. But before we do, I got a couple quick statistics. Everybody, the regular listeners know how much I love statistics. It gives you a real great perspective on things and knowing, getting some solid numbers, because so many times you take for granted, oh, everybody does this and everybody must have that and I think everybody knows. No, well, let's put it in statistics, put it in perspective, and you have a better idea of exactly what everybody means or whether it's true when you say that kind of stuff. Specifically, this one is from the New Popular Science magazine, which I just got a day ago. And it's just a little blurb with some statistics that I found interesting and I wanted to share with you. First of all, percentage of the world that is on the internet, of the world, is 10%. 90% of the people in the world don't have internet access, something that a lot of us in the United States take for granted. And the reason we take for granted is because the percentage of Americans that are on the internet is a whopping 65%. Huge, huge difference between the United States and the rest of the world as far as the percentage and number of people on the internet. So keep that in mind a lot of times. You know, the United States is not the internet. The internet is worldwide, but there are some parts of the world that still do not have the economic power. They don't have the technical power. They don't have the, frankly, some of them might not have the desire. Some countries still have government restrictions, any number of reasons. So keep that in mind sometimes and count your blessings on how good we have it sometimes, having internet access. It's not a right, it's a privilege. Anyway, out of those, this is another one I found interesting. This one surprised me. I didn't think this number was so high. But the American households with broadband internet access compared to those without broadband or narrowband or just plain old dial-up, we have 18 million people with broadband, which is approximately 30%. So out of that 65% of people with net access, 30% of those have DSL cable modem. They have some type of high-speed access. 42 million, which would be the other 70%, still use dial-up.
And are all still on AOL.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. God help them. Did you really... That surprised me. Did you think that 30% of the people had broadband already? I thought the number would be much lower. I was thinking maybe 10 to 15.
Yeah, I was thinking somewhere in that range, too. Lower teens, but...
But I guess what they're rolling it out. I don't think the... I think the price, the market price, the market entry point right now is... I think it's a little high, but I think it's at a good spot to get the majority of people who want that high-speed access. So I think right now it's good. I think it's bound to go down in the future as more competition for that market arises. But for right now, I think it's getting people who want to be on the front edge of technology, is what I'm trying to say, out there and running. So, yeah, I found those numbers interesting. And there's also a couple others here I wanted to share with you. And this is... We had talked probably on several occasions on past shows about email and how many spam messages there are, and I get an obscene number of spam messages. Here is some estimates. Here are some estimates, proper grammar. One typical day of email. One typical day from this past year. These are estimates, averages, whatever you want to call it. There were, on any one given day, 11.6 billion, billion with a B as in Bill Gates billion normal person-to-person emails, as in general, everyday, valid emails intended to be sent from person A to person B. 11.6 billion. In addition to that, there were 7.7 billion with a B spam emails sent. 7.7. Well, let's round that up to 8 and round the other one up to 12. So 8 to 12. So there's almost as many spam messages. For every 12, there's 8. 6 to 4, 3 to 2, so there's a 2 to 3 ratio there.
And a lot of spam.
That's all. And that, and back to what I said at the beginning, one day. Multiply that. You know what? It's staggering. It's just staggering. In addition to those two items, there's 4.6 billion alerts and notifications, which I think those are more along the lines of mailing lists and like order confirmation, stuff like that.
Oh, I was thinking more like 4 billion of those came straight from Microsoft.
Yeah.
In the form of alerts.
Exactly. They need it. That still wouldn't be enough to cover their security problem. So, yeah, those, man, that's a lot, and that's one typical day. I'm sure there were days when there were more spam messages than person-to-person messages. I'm sure there were. And who knows if, you know, that was for 2003. Who knows, by the end of 2003, maybe there were more or less, you know, the average. But the final stat I've got for you, and this is staggering, the total worldwide email sent in 2003. We are now in the 2004, January 2004. So from the year 2003, the total number of worldwide emails sent is approximately, now to put it in perspective, we told you there were how many billion on a typical day earlier. There were approximately 12.6 trillion with a TR, trillion, not to be confused with the instant message application trillion. There were 12.6 trillion emails sent worldwide last year. That's phenomenal.
The real question is, how many IMs were sent last year?
Oh, man. You count just individual conversations or each individual message within that conversation?
Each individual message.
Oh, Lord. Oh, man. That could get, whew. See, and there's our bandwidth. There's all our bandwidth, man. People sending, you know what, and let's go back to that again. 7.7 billion spam messages per day. Multiply that out, 12.6 trillion total in a 2 to 3 ratio. We're going to say, what is that, 8 trillion of those approximately. Am I off my math? I'm ballparking it right there. 8 trillion of those were No, that's too much. That's too high.
Yeah.
So let's see, 12.67. So it's probably Yeah, that's a little high. Probably, I don't know, we'll say half of that was for spam. And that's the cost to... Well, actually, who is that a cost to? Eating up bandwidth with this junk mail. Somebody has to pay for that.
You've got Comcast now. What do you care?
Well, you know what? That's right. Yeah, who cares about the rest of you on dial-up? Forget, if you're using AOL, you deserve it. Oh... All right, anyway, I'm sorry. I always find statistics incredibly, incredibly interesting. It really puts a perspective on things and lets you know exactly what is true and what isn't true. Yes, there's a famous book called How to Lie with Statistics, but if you see and understand the data, statistics don't lie. They really don't. Anyway, our main topic, and I'm going to turn most of this over to you, is I wanted to talk about the GPL because you and I had a really, really interesting discussion about, I did kind of a mini review on the Sun Java desktop system, their new desktop environment, which is a derivation of SUSE Linux. And we got into a conversation about how does a company do that, go about releasing a pay-only, a Linux distribution that you actually have to pay to use. Doesn't that conflict with the GPL? So I thought we'd just kind of cover, first of all, the GPL in general. So you know a lot more about it than I do. Don't sell yourself short. You know this a lot better than I do, frankly. So I'll ask the questions and I will learn from this segment, okay? You, first of all, what is the GPL? Let's start with the basics for some of our listeners who don't even know what GPL stands for.
Okay, the General Public License is basically a software license. Personally, I don't know the history of it all too well, so I couldn't tell you where it was, who originally wrote it, where it came from. But it's basically a license for all your open source, not all, a large amount of open source software that allows for modifications of, this is what makes open source for the most part to me. I don't know where to go from there.
Basically, free public license. It's free use, and I guess the big word that people get confused about is, what does free mean? Free as in no cost, free as in freedom, free as in, what is the point of the GPL in regards to making source code freely available? Are we allowed to charge money for the code that's in the GPL?
Well, that's what's funny, actually. One of the things we talked about was possibility of hooks in software, and we'll get to that in a second. But another thing the GPL allows for, well, we'll start out with the basic stuff. Basically, any GPL software you can download and use for free. What's funny is that if you read the GPL, it also says that you don't actually have to agree to the license to use the software, but you do have to agree to it to distribute it or to make changes to it. But basically, one of the things in the GPL that I find really funny is that you can charge for, let me find it, I'm actually got it up here, you may charge a fee for the physical act of transferring a copy, and you may, at your option, offer warranty protection. Well, that's not important, but the important part there is you may charge a fee for physical act of transferring a copy. That includes putting on a CD, and if you notice, there's no governing by part of the license saying, is there a limit to what you can charge? Which I find it terribly funny.
Right. Well, and historically, that's what a lot of the early distributions would do, is would charge, and this was back before broadband took off. If you wanted a copy of Linux, you would pay $5, $10, but it was still a reasonable amount. They would charge, you know, whatever it cost for them to copy it or burn it to a CD and mail it out to you if you wanted some of the earlier ones. If you didn't have... You know, if you were at a university or somewhere where you had a lot of bandwidth, you could download it and stuff like that, or you had local mirrors. But they made it, the whole original point of putting that in there was that it allowed people to share and spread Linux, but not go broke in the process, charge a fair amount to copy it. You know, back then, CDs cost more as well, so it cost a buck or two to burn a CD, and then to mail it, ship it to somebody, stuff like that. It helped spread the word and get the software out there and get the Linux distros, the early Linux distros, out to people.
But there's a problem in itself, though, that they never really defined how much you could charge for transferring.
Right. What is a fair amount?
Right.
And the other thing that you mentioned, the other, and I don't know if we should call these loopholes, these are intentional. You know, there's nothing wrong. Let me go on the record here, and I don't know if you're going to agree with me, but there's nothing wrong with making money in the software industry. There really isn't, if you do it right and play fair and play within the rules.
Oh, I completely agree. But this, I don't know, this could be considered, I think this is a bit underhanded. I mean, on one hand, you can use open source tools and write your own software that, in anything written, let's say you use GCC, which is under GPL, okay, let's say you write this whole thing under GPL, and let's say you even use VI, another GPL tool. That source code doesn't necessarily, you don't have to license that under GPL. Things you would have to license under GPL would be like if you took, let's say, you took the source code to VI and you wanted to add some features to it. Then that's when it falls under the GPL, you have to license it as GPL. But what I find underhanded about it are companies that can, I'll call them hooks in this case, because it's pretty much what it is. Let's say that you have this GPL piece of software. You want to base your product on it, but you don't want your product to be open source. What they can do is, let's say you have a, we'll take a very simple example. Let's say you have a text editor. We'll use VI again. Let's say you want to write some custom things to add on to VI to, I don't know, have it make coffee for you on your Linux coffee maker. I don't know. If you guys can think of some other examples for that, good. Anyway.
I like the coffee maker.
Okay, well, that works. Well, let's say you've got your own proprietary coffee maker that runs your own proprietary OS. Linux, in this case, won't work because, again, it's GPL. But let's say you've got your... Let's say Sun decided to make a coffee maker that runs Solaris. This is getting bizarre, but all right. If you could write a software API on top of a GPL piece of software, that would have to be GPL. You would have to release the source code. But the catch is, you don't necessarily have to release the proprietary part. Let's say that, you know, you write all this software that, these communications APIs or whatever for this coffee maker you have. You don't have to release the source code for the coffee maker, let's say the firmware that the coffee maker runs on, because technically that wasn't written under the GPL. It was your own source code. And the problem with that is, you can now write software that controls your coffee maker, but the problem is without the actual other piece of it, that software is useless. You can GPL it all day long. You can give it to your closest friend, your grandmother. It's not going to do you any good without this proprietary piece of code. And so it's a pretty underhanded way of getting around the GPL.
Right, and the reason that this came up, and the reason I want to talk about it, is specifically the Sun example. When we talked about the Sun Java desktop system, which is a derivation of SUSE Linux. I think it was SLC 1.0 of SUSE. They basically... See, this is the part that I want to make sure that listeners will understand, or at least grasp the concept of why there's a controversy or why there's a loophole or in the license is... Sun is a really good example, I think, because... Java programming environment, the Java development environment, is free, freely available. Download it, use it, write applications in Java. What else? Sun, oh gosh, they have other free...
Well, let's make a distinction real quick. Even though that Java is free, it's not GPL.
Right, and that's what I wanted to clarify. Just because they release a free software package and... they have SUSE. It's based on SUSE Linux distro, which is also under the GPL Linux kernel, a Linux distribution, which has to be made, source code has to be made freely available. They still somehow get away with charging for all this quote-unquote free software. So, you know, what is the distinction there? Why is this allowed to happen?
Well, again, I think it comes back down to the fact that you can write software using GPL tools and even for a GPL environment, but not necessarily have it based on anything previously GPL. And I think that's probably a lot of what they've done, is they've written, you know, their own interfaces and all this other stuff that wasn't based on anything that was GPL, so they can basically say, yeah, you can have the core system, but the user interface stuff is ours. We wrote it. I think that's what they're doing. Unlike, I think, was it Red Hat back in the day, or probably still does, you know, charge for support rather than actually selling a product.
Right. And I, again, back to, in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay to make money. You know, they can, as long as they're still making that source code freely available. And I think that's what's happened to them recently, is they finally decided, you know what, we're not making any money off of our typical everyday users. We're not making any money off people who download the source code because they don't pay for support. They don't even pay for, you know, the cost of distributing disks to them or stuff like that. So I think that's why they've pulled back and gone corporate, and they've released Fedora onto the world, is because they realize that that's not the way to make money using Linux. And unfortunately, that's a thought that I think the Linux community never worried about or foresaw. It was hoped that it would grow and become popular, but I don't think they foresaw this ability to be abused and this ability for... See, I don't know. I don't want to use the word abandoned, because Linux was there and growing, and open source software and stuff was growing before Red Hat, and it'll grow long after Red Hat. But to lose a heavy hitter like Red Hat is kind of scary.
Well, I don't know. It's not. I don't know. I don't think the ability for proprietary software to be written for Linux is such a bad thing. I don't think it's something. I think it, and if anything, helps growth, because now you start seeing companies like IBM step in. IBM, even Sun, started to move toward Linux for their high-end servers, you know, which is kind of funny. You know, they have Solaris, but we won't get into that. But I think it's a good thing in a way, because not only do you have companies now that are not only writing their own their own proprietary software for them, but that also forces Linux into mainstream even more, because now you've got corporations who, you know, have been using, we'll say Sun in this case, forever, I can't think of another good example, but some other large software vendor for a long time, you've been using their product for a long time, and all of a sudden now they're switching gears and saying, all right, well, we're writing on software for Linux now, and it's forcing Linux onto these main servers for these large corporations. I think it's pushing it more into the mainstream.
Yeah, well, and again, that's fine. That's a good thing for Linux to grow, but... Let me see if I can make up an example here. Let's say I'm on the spot here. Okay, let's say I wanted to write a new email client for Linux. Okay, I go out to OpenOffice.org. I get the source code for their standalone email part of their applications package. Okay, which is GPL. Am I correct?
I'm pretty sure it is. Yes.
Pretty sure it is. And
usually a Sun product, so I can't say that for sure, because it used to be Sun.
StarOffice, and OpenOffice.org is still the open source version that's still ongoing, I believe. If I'm incorrect, the point being, I take an open source GPL'd piece of software out there, a mail client that already exists, and I figure out a great anti-spam algorithm of my own, and I decide I don't want to GPL it. I don't want to put it out in the public. I'll take that GPL mail client, I'll write hooks into it for my proprietary spam filter. Can I or can I not then release my new mail client, Stank Mail, and charge money for it because it has my proprietary hooks, my new algorithm in there?
Well, technically, you're charging not really for the client itself. You can charge for, you know, anything that is, again, for the transfer of this GPL product. So that's not really what they're paying for. They're paying for the algorithm that you wrote, or this plugin that you wrote.
Right.
And the reason being is, it's not, as long as you don't base it on any prior GPL code, it's still legal. I don't find it right. I think it's actually quite wrong.
Right, and that's really the message I wanted to send, is I don't think that was the original intent. I don't think that was really the heart of the GPL. I don't think it was meant to be. I don't think this loophole was foreseen.
No, definitely not. I think when we were talking before, we were also talking about software that was written specifically for Linux that people could charge for and not have to release. that type of thing, I'm sure they saw, because that obviously pushes it more toward the commercial side, which is a good thing. But I definitely don't think they saw something like these types of loopholes.
Right, and then...
That's the whole point of a loophole, though, is something that wasn't foreseen to begin with.
Right. Right, and then, you know, to take it a step further, not only that email client, let's say Stank Mail is so popular, I decide, hey, I'm going to download SUSE's Linux distro, which is completely GPL. I'm assuming it may not be, but I find a Linux distro that's completely GPL'd.
Are you going to form Stankix?
And I'm going to make Bukakix. that was going to be our Linux distro, Bukakix. I make Stanksix or whatever, you know. All based on one simple little algorithm, I can now capitalize and charge money on the work of all the open source developers that made Linux what it is today and made that distribution what it is and made that mail application that I based on. That just doesn't feel right.
But what's funny is really you're not charging for what someone else did, because technically let's say that the operating system itself, the only thing that you wrote, the distribution itself, the only thing you wrote is that algorithm, that one specific plugin. Everything else is available free of source, and you're supposed to be able to provide with your distribution the source code for it. That's why Red Hat obviously had their source disks. Basically, since those are available, you're not charging for them. You're charging for your specific plugin, but you can wrap it around, you can wrap all this around your specific plugin and sell it as one big package. But you're not technically charging. You're not legally able to charge for the rest of it.
Right, but. In essence, I am.
Right. Well,
in essence, that's what's happening.
And that's what makes it so damned wrong.
Right, exactly. And to bring it back to that Sun JDS, they don't make the source code available that I can compile it and build it myself, because their portion of it, their plugins and their hooks, are not GPL'd. So you would think that they would have to make, I guess... What I would have to do is download, if I know it's based on SUSE SLC 1.0, I have to go download it. Then I have to go download the free applications that Sun has released. Even though it didn't release the source code itself, I could download the applications and install those, Star Office, Java Development, J2, SE, whatever it is, et cetera, and it's still not exactly the same, because I'm sure they've tweaked and customized that kernel and the interface with, I think it's KDE-based, I'm not positive.
And see, with things like that, that's what I don't understand. If they're doing things like that, if they actually make small tweaks, let's say that they took, you know, OpenOffice and they made small tweaks to it, they're supposed to release those changes that they've made. They don't have to release, like, their proprietary parts that, you know, would interface, that their tweaks would interface with, but they have to release the changes that they make. And that is clearly stated in the GPL.
Yeah, and who is the person that's going to enforce the GPL?
I think Stank should.
Yeah, right. I'll put that on my list of things to do. Hey, and in a weird kind of way, I am, because when I come on here and rant and I tell people, hey, Sun JDS is cool, but I don't support it because of this. You know, so in a way, I'm kind of fighting keeping it back. But, you know, I'm one person. Somebody has to enforce the GPL. And, of course, this is Sun we're talking about. Their pocketbooks are deep and their lawyers run long and wide.
And they probably have money in GPL, too, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You have all these corporations who openly donate money to these organizations, to the open source front, whatever it's called.
Yeah, that's another problem, huh?
Yeah, but I don't know.
Either way out of
things. I don't think there's... It's going to take some major... Not too major, but it'll take some definite changes.
Are there any chances or any changes in the future? Is there a GPL 2.0 coming up? Is there...
Not that I know of, but the more I think about it, I'm not real sure what they could do to
You know, you couldn't make it backwards compatible with everything else, but at least going forward for the future, you'd have a new, you know, start naming that everything now is under GPL 2.0.
But see, the only thing I could think of to stop it would be to claim that everything written for a GPL environment must be GPL itself. Which in that case, then who on earth who would be wanting to make money actually write software for, say, Linux?
Same people that have been writing and making that software all these years anyway before the big companies got involved? The hackers and the open source movement itself?
Those damn programmers.
Ah, troublemakers. Anyway, yeah, that was a very good discussion. We talked about this through Instant Messenger, believe it or not, which was Whew, that's a lot of typing.
Speaking of all those IMs per year.
Yeah, right. So I'm
that
glad
are fair share.
I'm glad we brought that up on the show. That was a very good topic. And if anybody has anything to add to that, by all means, write into us, letters@benrev.com, radio@benrev.com. Excuse me, that's the old address. Radio@benrev.com is the new feedback address. And I think, let's jump forward a little bit now. We started last week. We've only got a few minutes here left. But last week we started the list of 101 ways to save the Internet. And this is a list, this is an article from Wired Magazine. And it's a bunch of short comments, short ideas on what can fix some of the problems that are going on with the Internet. And it's debatable whether or not these are problems, whether these are just ideas, whatever. So last week we ended on number 20, which was rolled out Gap for Geeks, and you can check last week's episode 27 for that. This week we're going to start with number 21, and we're going to pound through a few of these. I don't know how much, you know, we don't have too much time left. Number 21 is Bring on the Perp Walks. I know that's a little difficult to understand, but they say that we want, I'm going to quote this, we want to see the next CEO whose company servers leaked 10,000 credit card numbers marched past TV cameras by the FBI. See, I like that idea. If some hacker, they're going to march them in front of cameras and have the FBI trailing along behind them and throw them in jail and stuff. Let's start holding the correct people accountable for those actions. The person, the idiot who's running a system that makes them vulnerable, make him accountable for this stuff, as well as whoever does the deed itself. And that kind of goes back to where we ended last week, number 20, the Gap for Geeks, which was holding people account, making an industry standard for security and making companies and website owners and ISPs comply with those, you know, and they have to comply with those. So that would actually work pretty well together. Number 22, Take Back UHF. We're tired of running our wireless network on the same frequency as the microwave, the cell phone, and the neighbor's baby monitor. Channel 83 is just sitting there. Well, nobody's using UHF is what their point is. Is that true?
I think in our area, when we're talking about UHF TV stations, we have three, I think.
Yeah. I don't know. You know what? I wish Mute would know that. If he's listening, write in to me, Mute. Tell me what you think of that one. Taking back UHF. Is it time to let go, to abandon UHF and use it for other stuff? Let us know. Number 23, offer real RIAA amnesty. Instead of telling us to delete MP3s or pay a fine, how about you let us pay a fair price to keep them? That goes back to one we had before, too. The second one, actually, from last week. Slash song prices. Charge 29% per download. You'll make it up in volume. I said that then, I'll say it again now, 29 cents, I'd buy a lot of MP3s. I'd buy everything I have in my collection and have it fairly and legally on my hard drive.
But can we have some third party determine what's a fair price?
Well, of course.
Yeah, because for those MP3s, they're 20 grand a piece.
Yeah, exactly. The RAAs, well, it looks like their 99 cents is where they're going to try to draw the line, and that's just still too much for me.
Yeah.
You know? 50 cents, I said, was reasonable. But at 50 cents, I would only buy some really, the songs that I really, really liked from groups are really 29 cents or 25 cents even. I would buy a lot more stuff. And that's right, making up.
I might buy the whole damn thing.
Yeah.
Actually, you guys should check out the Apple's keynote address earlier this week. They were showing their iTunes store, saying showing the top buyer bought over 30,000 songs.
Damn.
What in the hell do you do with 30,000 songs?
How long would it take you to listen to 30,000 songs? I want to know who that was.
Some poor kid with his parents' credit card, probably.
Yeah. One of some radio station bought them and now can legally play them on. There's a loophole that we're missing. Number 24, release episode 3 on the net. It's going straight to video anyway. Oh, that's just wrong. That's just rude. Oh, man, that's cold-hearted. It's right, but...
Yeah.
That was pretty bad. They better come back strong with episode 3, but anyway. Number 25. Actually, I had hoped to end on 25 last week because this is a good one. Number 25, pass a White Hat Protection Act. Hackers who find holes in corporate networks should get thanks, not handcuffs. tough. That's going to be tough to enforce. Ideally, I would love that, but that's tough to enforce because suddenly everybody's going to jump behind that. Oh, I'm white hat. You can't punish me. I didn't break into the bank on purpose. I was white hat. I was trying to, you know.
Yeah, that's a pretty big umbrella. Because I mean, you know, okay, well, let's say Tom down the street breaks into IBM and steals all their, you know, new projects, but then he tells them they have a security hole.
Yeah, after the fact.
I should get a parade.
Yeah, you get handcuffs.
While selling them off to Sun. Or to Microsoft.
You know, we're really low on time. The next section is about spam. They've got 8 here. Yeah, I'm going to hammer through these super fast. They have 8 in a little spam section. All these relate to spam. And it has a little disclaimer at the beginning saying that none of these is a magic bullet, but together they can force junk mail down to levels we can live with. So I'm just going to hammer through these quickly. Number 26, pass a do not spam list. I mentioned this on air a long time ago. We got a do not call list. What about a do not spam list? You know, it's not completely enforceable. They say that in here too, but, you know, at least it's something, a step in the right direction. Number 27, automate the FTC. Replace the Federal Trade Commission's manual email address for reporting spam with a nationwide collaborative filtering service like CloudMark's SpamNet. Number 28, simplify disposable addresses. That's an interesting one. Disposable addresses? Number 29, stop email forgery. A geeky feature called Reverse MX makes it impossible to masquerade as G.W. Bush at whitehouse.gov. Frankly, I've never heard of that. Reverse MX?
I have never have either. I generally have a PHP script that connects back to the SMTP server to verify the user, but...
Yeah, and that's fairly common. That's what I've never heard of Reverse MX. I might have to look that one up. Number 30, scramble archived addresses. Online archives of mailing lists or a treasure trove for spammers give members the option to have their address scrambled in posts. Man, that might be a nuisance, though. I don't know, to legitimate people, but the way we do it in the forums is we have those stored in a database separately, and the database is protected by password, and the getting access to the database is protected by a different password, so I don't know if that one's really worthwhile. I guess it depends on how the software is set up. Number 31, enable digital signatures.
That would be great.
Yeah, see, that's been out for a while, and why hasn't that caught on more?
Because for the most part, I think we talked about this one episode that I was on, about how the most email clients that are out there that do support signatures and keys in some way, or public key encryption, aren't that easy to use sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. If they make a nice simple plug-in for the big clients... It would go miles. It would go a long way. 32, build friend-of-a-friend filters. Think of it as Friendster for your inbox. Everyone on our list can email everyone on yours, but outsiders have to fill in annoying spam cop forms. I don't know. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That seems a bit too cumbersome to me. I think that comes along the same lines as signatures, is that, you know, it's got to be simple.
Yeah, for people like me, I guess for some people it would be great. People who are in like a business environment, that would probably be really good. But for people like me, I get a lot of, well, for example, half the emails we started the show with, two of the three were from people who are new that would not have been in my friends list or friends of friends list that are new listeners, and I would have gotten them blocked out. So, you know, people like me who get a lot of email from first-time people or introductions from brand-new people that are... You know, finding out about the site, that's no good for somebody like me, but I guess at a business or something, it could work pretty well. And the last one in this section, and we'll close with this, is number 33, create a peer-to-peer or P2P email program. We directly trade MP3 files, instant messages, and now phone calls without the bother of back-end services. Why not email messages? I don't think I get that at all. Why would... I don't think I get that. I'm missing something. What am I missing there? Am I missing something?
I think I missed it, too.
Let me read that again, because I don't... Create a P2P email program.
We directly trade MP3 files, instant messages, and now phone calls without the bother of back-end servers. So why not email messages?
Simple answer to that is, if anyone's ever hosted their own email server on a dial-up or even a broadband connection, it's a pain in the ass to keep host names correct.
Yeah.
So having your personal email client be its own email server would be damn near impossible, especially with IPv4 and this lack of IP addresses, so everybody's behind in that at some point anyway. So maybe with IPv6, when everybody's got their own IP, and then when they produce the IP Portability Act.
IPv6, I haven't heard that in a while. I might have to see what the status on that is, because I haven't heard any news on that in quite a while. But that is going to have to be a topic for another show, because I think we are out of time, well out of time as usual. Another packed episode. So, let's see. Yep, we're going to have to bump that again. And you know what I'm talking about. What kind of shouts? You got shout-outs this week?
Actually, I just got one looking down here. Shouts to Bland. I finally got around looking at his site and listening to some of his music. You are one strange cracker, but you've got some great music.
I'm going to go with that, too. That's my shouts, Bland Inquisitor. You know, people pigeonhole hackers, and they try to classify, and I said at the beginning, trying to define a hacker, go back and listen, I'm not going to repeat it, but we're not quite as simple and as easy to pin down a definition, because we are human beings, and every single person is different. We have different skills, we have different interests, not all hackers are computer engineering majors that sit in front of a computer screen all day. Some of us have degrees in music, some of us have degrees in philosophy, some of us have degrees in business, all kinds of things, and we have different hobbies and skills. Some of us are rednecks, some of us are gangsters, some of us are geeks, some of us are women dressed like men. They run the gamut, just like society in general. Everybody out there is different, and it's the same thing with hackers. So the reason I say that is because Bland Inquisitor just amazes me, because he has such a gift for music. The guy is talented. So forget the fact that he's an elite hacker. Forget the fact that he's on the radio every week on Radio Freak America, and that he's in the forums, published in 2600 magazine. On top of all that, the guy is a brilliant classical guitarist. The guy, and not just classical, the guy can play. The guy's got skills. And that is our closing music this week, is actually a track from the Bland Inquisitor. It's one I liked, one of my favorites, called Sunrise. I hope the stream will do the song justice. If not, please go check out BlandInquisitor.com and listen to the high-quality version that he has available there. It's great, great stuff. Very talented people, like everybody in the hacking community. We have other talents and other skills, and people need to appreciate that more. We are more well-versed, more well-rounded people than the media may make it seem. I'm not saying that to be on a soap opera. I'm saying that out of respect for Bland and people like him who have just phenomenal skills. I've said many times, art is not my thing. I am not an art person. I can't draw stick people. I can't make music. I don't have that gift. And when I see people that have other skills like that, I have nothing but praise and good things to say about them. So I'm going to close with his track called Sunrise. Email us, radio@benrev.com. And Voodoo Hal, thank you again. Another great show. Thank you for being back. We'll have you back again very soon, I hope, if you can make it.
Okay, thanks for having me.
All right, and to the listeners, we will see you all next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.
Later. Thank you.
Thank you.